So, hello, it's Abigail Morris here, and welcome to another episode of Life Dunk. And with me in the studio, we have Rabbi Miriam Berger.
Hello, nice to see you.
And for the first time, very exciting, we have a new guest, Stuart Link, who's a psychologist.
Hi there.
So welcome, and we are going to talk, about alcohol. And we're going to start by talking about Dry January, because that's what a lot of people are going to be thinking about. But for those of you who don't know what it is, Stuart, would you like to tell us?
Yeah, so Dry January is a month after Christmas and New Year, and after all the celebrations that go on. And it's an organisation, I think it might be a charity, who are very aware that people probably drank rather a lot over Christmas and New Year. And now they're thinking, is that good for me? And one of the things that Dry January has showed is that by reducing your consumption over January, that stands you in good stead for the rest of the year. So even if you don't think you're going to stick to your New Year resolutions, what does happen is you reduce your alcohol consumption over January. That means you're going to improve your health. And also for the next year, you'll probably manage to keep at least a bit of it going.
And something we'll come back to, presumably slightly easier that other people are doing it with you.
Sure. I mean, it's a community thing, and it's massive stuff on the web about it. And they also have an app which you can look at. And that app will help you monitor your drinking and think about whether you're drinking within the limits that you're setting for yourself.
Great. So, Miriam, as a rabbi, how would Dry January affect Jewish life?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because I think we have a self-perception of the Jewish community that we are not big drinkers and that we don't drink much. But obviously we use wine particularly as a way of marking time and elevating moments, elevating days. And so, you know, nowadays in synagogues particularly, there's always a grape juice option when wine is being offered. But could you do kind of Shabbat and Jewish life fully abstaining from alcohol is an interesting question, and one that actually Judaism doesn't really give you a fixed view on. I think it gives us both, it tells us to drink and it gives us our warnings.
So it tells us to drink Friday night. When else does it tell us to drink?
Well, look, I mean, my son had his first sip of wine when he was 8 days old, sipping wine off of my finger as he underwent his circumcision, his Brit Milah, which I don't think is an uncommon way of kind of pacifying a baby during that little minor procedure. And so it's interesting that we kind of build up this very, I would say, blasé relationship with alcohol in Judaism. And it's used at all sorts of milestones of kind of weddings and a big milestone moment, but also at certain festivals, whether that's the four cups of wine prescribed during the Pesach Seder, or whether that's really drinking to excess on Purim, where we're told that we should drink to a point of not knowing the difference between the curses of Haman the baddie in the story and the blessings of Mordechai, one of the better characters in the story.
So, Stuart, can you talk a little bit about what alcohol does to you and why it might be good in some cases and not good in others?
Yeah, I think you just described a very good example of binge drinking followed by a period of abstinence, which I think is one of the patterns that people get into. I would like to start by clarifying a few things about alcoholism and alcohol use disorders and problem drinking. There's a lot of different terms get thrown around. So alcoholism is when people become physically dependent on drink. It means if they stop drinking, they're going to get withdrawal symptoms. And if someone's drinking very, very heavily and then they suddenly stop, that is dangerous medically. They can end up in hospital. It can be very serious. And I think start off with that general health warning is if you're drinking a lot, don't suddenly stop, but get some medical advice. I think Dry January, the idea of dry is also, it's not necessarily being totally dry. I mean, again, that's the idea of being a dry house with people who are addicted. I think what Dry January is about is taking control of your drinking and making sure that you're drinking according to what would be the right level for you to promote your health and general well-being. So there are some people who say there's no safe level of alcohol consumption. And alcohol, I'm not sure I agree with that. I think drinking can be fine in moderation or under control. Certainly, I enjoy it myself from time to time. But what we need to be thinking about is what are the right levels of drinking. And the the government do produce some guidelines, and they say 14 units a week, but for men and women. It used to be different. Men and women were different, but now it's the same. 14 units a week with at least 2 or 3 days completely free of alcohol, so it gives your body a chance to detox. If you don't do that, you do run the risks of a number of different health problems. So it contributes, as everyone probably knows, it contributes to liver disease. It can contribute to cancer. It can contribute to heart disease. It's not good for diabetes, or people sometimes say it is. There's a bit of a myth around red wine's good for you. There's no evidence to say that, although people might like to believe that. And of course, it also contributes to lots of mental health problems. That's if you're drinking consistently over a longish period of time. In the short term, obviously, people want to give you a hangover. But also, you're more prone to take risks. You know, we know not to drive over after drinking. But also, even a small amount of alcohol can affect the way in which we manage machinery. So I wouldn't want to take my electric drill and start doing some drilling after a couple of glasses of rather strong wine.
It also affects relationships in that way too. You might take risks with your relationship if you're not drinking.
Where do we begin? I mean, in terms of drinking and domestic violence, drinking and crime, drinking and all kinds of problems, social problems, crime is very associated with crime. An awful lot of people who commit violent offences have done so under the influence of alcohol. Yeah.
So do you think, Miriam, that drinking so young has an effect on how, and the fact that it's very much part of Jewish culture has an effect on how Jews view alcohol and whether they use it to excess or not?
It's really interesting because we have Jewish charities to support a huge number of very specific issues within the Jewish community and don't have a charity focused on people who are addicted to alcohol. And one might see that as a reflection of, I think, a self-perception within the community is that we're not big drinkers and that we don't have an issue with alcohol. And that one could say, well, maybe that's because it's not seen as this sort of forbidden entity and that when something is kind of encouraged in a sensible way and in moderation, that goes on to be our relationship with it. Or it could be that actually it's one of these hidden issues within community and that actually there are many people grappling with having a difficult relationship with alcohol. But because it's so present, it's much more difficult to admit to because where else are you sort of forced to publicly have a sip of wine when actually you might be trying kind of not to, there might very much feel like a community sense of obligation to drink wine at Kiddush. And if one doesn't feel confident in that space to say no thank you, it can be very hard.
Do you see that as a problem?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of issues really that come out of this idea that Jews don't drink, or that by sipping wine, you know, on a Friday night somehow inoculates you from future risks. I've no idea if that's true or not. Right? I do know that generally speaking in the alcohol treatment and research community, there is evidence that the earlier you start drinking, the more likely you are to carry on heavy drinking later in life. But I think that depends an awful lot on the cultural context. So in the context of a family where it's authorised or where it's controlled and observed, that's probably not the case. And also kids learn from their parents how to drink. So if their parents are drinking moderately, the chances are that they will as well. They might drink crazily for short periods of time, but that doesn't necessarily carry on. I think one of the consequences of this idea that Jews don't drink very much means that we don't have any good research, because no one's ever raised the issue, how much do Jews drink? So I don't think there's occasionally surveys, but not much good data. There was one study in the Canadian Jewish community, it was a few years ago, it was a pilot study, which showed that a large number of non-Jewish people knew somebody who had a drinking problem, or they believed that someone had a drinking problem. So it may be more prevalent than we think it is. The other issue is a bit like Rabbi Miriam was saying, which is that if you think that everybody else isn't drinking, you're not going to admit to it yourself. You'll be a bit embarrassed to say, oh, I've actually got a drinking problem. I think because the community doesn't endorse it, really. It always says, no, you must be a bit strange if you're drinking heavily.
So in fact, the perception of the non-drinking culture actually rather than making things better, what you're actually saying is it makes things worse because those people who need the help won't get it.
I think it's complicated. I think it sets a standard, doesn't it? So people would then think, well, that's what everyone else is drinking, so I'll try and match that standard. I'll also be like everybody else. On the other hand, if you're drinking beyond that, maybe secretly drinking or drinking more than you realise, and I will come to that in a bit, then you're unlikely to even acknowledge to yourself that might be an issue.
Well, why don't we, let's talk about drinking more than you realise. Let's jump in there now.
Okay, so people drift in and out of heavy drinking. You know, I think there are times of crisis, times of stress. People drink more. They may cut it down at different times. Interestingly, the levels of alcohol consumption were generally going down until the pandemic, and they've sort of peaked again a little bit since then. I don't know whether that's reduced. And just to talk one more thing about stress before I go on to that, is that there is some data coming out of Israel that general rates of addiction have gone up since the war started. And not surprisingly, but that's true. And particularly for people who have been in active service, you know, just come back from Gaza or something. But to come back to our local community and think about why it is that you might be drinking more than you think you are, is because no one counts. If it's a part of your regular lifestyle, let's say it's as a habit that the bottles of wine come in with the Tesco's order, you know, so you haven't got to go out and get it anymore. It's very easy just to have alcohol at home stored up somewhere. And a half a bottle in the evening shared between a couple of people becomes the norm. And then maybe, oh, what's the point? It's nearly finished, the bottle. We may as well finish it because it's going to go off by tomorrow, so we may as well get it done now. You know, that kind of reasoning and drinking with meals, that's okay, isn't it? And it is. It's absolutely fine, but not every night of the week. And I think that's where it becomes very habitual. And there are some ways of thinking about, for yourself, whether you are becoming a bit more dependent on alcohol than you perhaps realise. One of those, and it's most people know this, is increasing tolerance. So if you, what used to give you a good, nice, easy feeling, relaxed feeling after half a bottle of wine, suddenly becomes three quarters of a bottle of wine, becomes a full bottle of wine, and maybe a spirit afterwards as well, especially on a Friday night, why not? That's one thing, that's an obvious one. The ones that are less obvious are things like, do you think about drink a lot? Do you think about when your next drink is going to be? You know, are you planning? I would go out, but I need to have a glass of wine, so I take the car or not, but I really want to drink, so I better not take the car. When that starts to dominate your mind, not just a kind of sort of, oh, it's convenient to get a bus, you know, and I should do. When that becomes dominant in your mind, that's quite a sign that you might become more dependent. When you're drinking in regular habits, when it's the same time every day, every week, it's the same drink as well, you're not changing your drink very much. None of these are definitive. It's all that when you notice the pattern. And these are good signs that you might become dependent. Of course, other people start to notice, but they don't say anything. So that might be, you know, I do remember somebody who, every time I was on a Zoom meeting, there was always a glass of wine there. Now, I didn't like to ask, I didn't like to say anything, but I noticed it. And because people going out less, it's easy. There was Netflix, nice meal, takeaway, bottle of wine, nice evening. How many nights a week is that? So those are the kind of habitual things that you can get into. One of the easiest ways is to start counting. People don't like to count because it makes it rather obvious. There was an advert for recycling, I think I saw once, with how many green bottles have you got in your recycling bin? Mm. I thought, that's a really interesting one. Is that a way of showing off that you're drinking something because of a lot of bravado about drinking, which we haven't talked about? Or is that just I'm a very conscientious recycler, I collect the bottles from all my friends. I doubt it, but it might be the case. So counting. And so one simple way is a drinking diary. This is where Dry January have got a very good app. There are other apps as well. And you basically just count how often you have a drink. And standard ways of measuring it, which is a unit of alcohol. Interestingly, it used to be the case that a single glass of wine in a pub was one unit, but now the glasses have got bigger. So now you're asked, do you want a large glass or a small glass? Do you always ask for a large glass or do you always ask for a small glass? Those are questions to ask yourself. So counting how much you actually drink is important. And then it's really helpful to get a sort of when, where, with whom, how are you feeling before and afterwards. Those kinds of things will start to give you a clue as to what your own level of alcohol consumption is. And as I say, the units, the recommended units are 14 units a week. That doesn't mean that you have to drink up to 14 units a week. That means if you are drinking that much, that is generally considered to be not risk-free, but less risky drinking the more. Now, that means that's a kind of steady drinking. There's people who binge, who have get all their 14 units going one night, not a good idea, probably testing your liver to quite some extreme value, and you might not be able to perform very well at work next day if you do that.
So, Miriam, there's a lot of wisdom in Judaism and the rabbis. Do they talk about alcohol?
They definitely do, because although we think of alcohol as being the thing that's kind of prescribed in our Jewish practices, like our 4 glasses of wine at the Pesach Seder, which some might see as kind of excess, there's definitely warnings scattered through our texts. So whether that's seeing examples of people who fall from grace because of the what they're drinking. So Noah is a good example of that. That he goes from being the righteous man in his generation to inappropriate sexual relationships when he's on dry land after the flood. And that's seen as a direct response to planting vineyards as their first thing that they do when they're on dry land. There's all sorts of midrashim stories around perhaps the tree of knowledge in the Garden of Eden was actually a vine, and that's why Adam and Eve didn't behave so well and didn't manage to stick to the rules of not drinking and not eating from the fruit, because actually it was seen as a statement about alcoholism. And we're told Aaron's sons who are killed because of this strange practice that they do with kind of strange fire, not Jewish practice, is also we're alerted to as being something that they did that because they were drunk. But my favorite story is actually a Talmudic one based in Tractate Megillah. So it's about Purim. And on Purim, we're told this is when we are meant to drink to excess. But it's as if the rabbis in the Talmud also wanted to warn us about what can happen when you drink too much. So we're told this story of Rabba and Rabbi Zaira, who get together for their Purim Seudah, their meal on Purim afternoon. And during this feast, they get very drunk. And Rabba gets up, and we're told he literally butchers Rabbi Zaira. He cuts his throat. And the next day, Rabba, clearly in a kind of hungover stupor, realizes what he's done and prays on Rabbi Zaira's behalf. And his prayers bring him back to life. But we're told a year later, Rabba invites Rabbi Zaira back to his house to share the Purim Seudah with him again that year. And Rabbi Zaira very wisely says, "No, thank you. One cannot count on a miracle every time." And for me, it's just this great warning, you know, taken from sort of the second century of the Common Era, already people being able to say, look, I can see what happens when people drink to excess. And we were lucky this time. Maybe next time we won't be so lucky. And I was interested, you know, Stuart said about, we know we don't drink and drive. But I think it's also that piece around, but when you stop counting, you know, when do you go by that, oh, I'm sure I'm fine to drive piece, which I think in different generations is also more apparent, that sometimes it's people who are kind of older and more used to drinking that actually take that risk a little bit more and say, oh, I'm sure I'll be fine. And it's as if Rabbi Zaira is reminding us that just because you were fine last time doesn't mean you'll be fine this time.
And can you bear to talk about what makes wine kosher, Miriam?
I can't, because I actually loathe the rules around kashrut when it comes to wine. I find it deeply embarrassing, and I understand where it came from. Essentially, from the moment that the grapes are being picked all the way through until the wine is poured into your glass, none of the moments in that process, from picking the wine to pouring the wine, are non-Jews allowed to be part of that process. Now, just that statement sounds racist, and kind of is, until you say, well, it comes from a practice where libations, wine offerings, were kind of part of not just our culture, but cultures around us. And therefore, how could you ensure that the wine you were drinking had not been used as a libation, as a way of giving thanks or pray or kind of worshipping idols, essentially. And so it feels like a sensible safeguard to the rule that at a time when people were using wine to worship idols and then reusing that wine potentially in drinks that they were serving to their house guests, okay, we didn't touch wine that was touched by non-Israelite, non-Jewish hands because it could have been used in the worship of idols. But I'm absolutely 100% sure that basically no bottle of wine on any shelf in any local supermarket has ever been used at any point in the process to have been used in really any kind of religious worship, let alone paganism. And therefore, the idea that we still have these rules, particularly I find it difficult in an environment where there are non-Jewish waiting staff and that they have to, you know, get the Jewish waiter to pour the wine because they know that they're not allowed to touch your wine. I do find it deeply, deeply embarrassing. So, you know, there's something about, say, the taste of Palwin or Kedem, which tastes like Kiddush. But to me, the idea that I would only drink Hechshed wine with a meal gets me into the whole values-driven kind of culture of what are our rules of kashrut there for? And I just find that deeply challenging to know that a bottle of wine has got Hechshed on it.
Yeah, it's a slightly kind of, now I hadn't thought of it before, but that idea of people spiking your drink, that same fear of someone. Have you dealt with that? And kind of, is that something that happens?
Not professionally. I mean, I've certainly heard of it. Yes, I mean, it's definitely true. I just wanted to come back and think a bit more about the ritualized use of wine, because we do, what do we say when we have a drink? L'chaim. It's a life. Why is wine to life? Why is alcohol to life?
Well, you said something when we were preparing this podcast. You said there's nothing that humans can't turn into alcohol. Is that what you said?
I mean, it's a genius of the human race to turn anything that grows into alcohol. I've not found an example yet. I'm not sure peanuts. I'm sure it can be done, though. It's a challenge for somebody.
To turn it in. And so what do you think we're saying? So I'm going to turn that question back to you. What do you think we're saying when we... I mean, even the thing of when you have a l'chaim, when you is literally you have a drink, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I've been around quite a lot of different parts of the Jewish community in my life, and I've certainly been at early morning minions, you know, where a schnapps, mushka, vodka is just available to toast a yahrzeit or something, you know, a whiskey kiddush, you know, during musaf service, has been there, but also lots and lots of people drinking rather more than four glasses of wine, you know, whatever denomination they have to be from, during Pesach. I mean, I do think that the sacramental, to use that word, use of alcohol is very important. I mean, why is it called spirit? A spirit, you know, because it lifts the spirits. There's something about the power of alcohol to transform you from one state to another. It's something that's valued and is important. It's a pity when it becomes something that is spoiled by drunkenness or when it's making you unhealthy.
Yeah. So you're for an elegant moderation.
That's right, yes.
It's interesting that even in biblical times, though, abstinence was seen as a kind of higher purpose. So one took a Nazarite vow,
yes,
which was the closest, I suppose, Judaism gets to kind of a monastic type of life.
Yeah.
And immediately that takes out alcohol.
Yes.
So it's interesting to see that even in cultures where it's kind of used in religious worship, and kind of given to us in this way of, you know, raising the kind of atmosphere of a moment or yeah. elevating a day by making kiddush, we say, the blessing of the day to give purpose to this moment.
Yeah.
Even in that culture, actually, it was recognized that abstinence was better ultimately.
So I'll come back now to what you can do. And abstinence is certainly one way, you know, especially if you know that your drinking has become too much and too heavy, then not drinking for a bit can be helpful, providing you're doing it in a safe way, you're not previously dependent. But reducing alcohol step by step is quite a useful thing. Setting targets for yourself, having it as part of your general health program, if you like. Especially, I think, Dry January is particularly well-timed because people are making New Year resolutions and they're saying, OK, I've indulged myself over Christmas, I've been to the office parties, we've had a very big New Year. I think Hanukkah is more eating chocolate and donuts than alcohol, but nevertheless, you know, you could use it as an excuse if you wanted to. But setting in January a New Year resolution for yourself and say, okay, this is what my limit's going to be. I'm going to monitor what I do and I'm going to reward myself. If I've managed to not drink more than X, I'm going to put the money I would have spent on the alcohol away and use it for a present or use it for some other purpose, even give it to tzedakah, maybe. But maybe just use it for yourself as well. And I think that's where I suppose come back to Wellspring a bit, and I'm interested to hear your view about this, Miriam, is if you're deciding to make changes in your life and you want to say, right, now I want to make a place to start, I want to have a program, I want people to support me, do you think Wellspring would be something that would be a useful way to do that, place to do that?
Absolutely. And it's, I think, for two main reasons. One, because I think the thing that we kind of specialize in is marking time and allowing people to set goals. So the challenge of a New Year's resolution is that it feels like it's forever, and changing one's habits forever can feel daunting and difficult, and it's easy therefore to kind of to stop or to give up. Mm. But just to be able to break down time and to be able to say, what does it look like to mark each week? And to be able to count the 7 days of the week until you've reached one milestone, or the days of a month until you've reached another month, and to keep counting like that is definitely where Wellspring will come into it. And that ability to be able to also see the changes in one's body and to be able to mark those moments, perhaps with a mikveh or perhaps in water, a way of being able to physically say, I'm here, I've arrived, now I'm taking my steps into the next chunk of time, it can be very powerful. And the other piece is accountability. I think often we have these thoughts in our heads of, this is what I'm going to do. But it's very difficult if we don't share that with other people and they're not on a journey with us.
So
whether we are in relationships with friends, family, partners who can hold us to account in a gentle and supportive way, or whether we need the community of Wellspring to be doing that with us or together as a group, there's something very powerful in that sense of accountability of, we're doing this together and I don't want to let anybody else down by not...
As you were speaking, I was wondering whether following the cycle of the week was actually a good way of doing that. So rather than ending, you know, Shabbat with a malacha melka that involved lots of alcohol, to have it in a different way, you know, that then on Friday night you can say, well, look, this is how I've done this week, and now I can go into Shabbat with a kind of restful atmosphere.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I love the idea of using mikveh, using water to celebrate not drinking. There's a rather nice...
Not turning the water into wine, because that's not what we do.
But thank you very much, Stuart, and thank you very much, Miriam. And if you're enjoying Dry January, then do enjoy it and do it safely. Take care.